Well, thank you for your welcome, and I just convey the greetings to you from Inverness Reformed Baptist Church, the Highland Theological College. Apparently this is the 12th time I've spoken here, so there you go. And we're looking today at the Great Ejection. So a bit of background. The English Puritans, the main subject for today, have probably been more admired, at least by Reformed believers, than any other body of English Christians. As you may know, they started out as a movement within the Reformed Anglican Church back in the reign of Queen Elizabeth I, pressing for further reformation of the national church. Now, by the time we meet them in this talk, the Puritan movement has become far more complicated and difficult to define. Many who began as Puritans had, by our period, passed into separatism. That is, they no longer sought to reform the Anglican Church, but separated from it as beyond the possibility of reformation. Now, as Chris said, we're commemorating this year a great anniversary in Puritan history, the 350th anniversary of the Great Ejection of 1662. Now, that year marked the final defeat of Puritanism as a force dedicated to reforming the Church of England. The majority of Anglican ministers with Puritan sympathies were that year cast out of the national church, and any who remained had to lay aside their Puritanism forever. The consequences for English Christianity were deep and lasting. So, how did all this happen? Well, very briefly, Puritanism had finally enjoyed a period of triumph and success as a result of the English Civil War in the 1640s. Parliament and its army had overthrown the traditional Anglican church and monarchy. But even in triumph, there were shadows of future disaster looming for Puritans and their sympathisers. And the chief shadow was the catastrophic breakdown of Puritan unity. The mainstream Puritan movement split apart into a Presbyterian and independent or congregationalist wing, quarrelling bitterly over church government, religious toleration, and the desirability of a monarchy. The Presbyterian wing had recoiled in horror at the execution of King Charles I by the independent wing and its allies who dominated the army. The only thing that held England together and prevented anarchy was the strong hand of Oliver Cromwell, the army leader, who ruled the land as a virtual military dictator. Cromwell was an independent, but his death in 1658 left a power vacuum that plunged the land into chaos. Out of the plots and counterplots of different factions, one dominant power emerged, General George Monk, a royalist who had switched sides and was Cromwell's military governor of Scotland. Monk now switched sides again, marched his army down into London in February 1660, and took charge of the political landscape. He restored the Presbyterians to Parliament. The army had purged them in 1648. As I mentioned, Presbyterians had opposed the execution of Charles I, and they now favoured the restoration of the monarchy, as Monk himself did. Their only condition was that the exiled Charles II, son of Charles I, would guarantee religious freedom for Presbyterians. After getting the MPs on board with his purpose to restore the king, Monk then persuaded Parliament to dissolve itself legally and authorise fresh elections, so that a new contemporary House of Commons might give legitimacy to a revived monarchy. To the horror of Presbyterians, however, Anglican royalists did extremely well in the general election, and the resulting convention parliament was evenly divided between the two parties. From his exile in the Dutch Republic, Charles played his hand well. On Monk's advice, he issued the Declaration of Breda in April 1660, in which he promised religious toleration and an amnesty for all acts committed in the Civil War. Charles was probably sincere in his declaration of intent. He had no stomach for religious persecution or religious controversy or indeed religion, and was determined simply to get back on the throne, where he was to become chiefly famous for his extramarital affairs. The Earl of Rochester allegedly said of Charles, "We have a pretty, witty king whose word no man relies on. He never said a foolish thing and never did a wise one." If political policy required it, however, Charles could be as intolerant as any religious zealot. On receiving the Declaration of Breda, the Convention Parliament passed the Act of Indemnity and Oblivion, granting the suggested amnesty, with a few exceptions, the regicides, those responsible for Charles I's execution. Then the MPs invited Charles home. He arrived amid huge popular rejoicing in May. General Monk was suitably rewarded by being made Duke of Albemarle. Parliament was again dissolved in December, and new elections produced in May 1661 the Cavalier Parliament, which was overwhelmingly Anglican royalist in membership, with hardly a Presbyterian in sight. The head of Charles II's new administration was Edward Hyde, Earl of Clarendon, a devout Anglican. Under Clarendon's guidance, the Cavalier Parliament proceeded to enact a new religious settlement for the country. The fiercely Episcopalian nature of this settlement and its oppressive character toward non-Episcopalians derived from Parliament rather than from the king. Charles himself was prepared to be more tolerant, but the Anglican royalist MPs were in no mood to be generous to the Presbyterians, Independents and Baptists who had humiliated them on the battlefield, outlawed their worship and killed their king. Charles had no choice but to fall in with this vengeful mood. He could rule only through his parliamentary supporters. The whole country indeed seemed to be in an anti-Puritan state of mind, a strange amalgam of Episcopalian religious fervour and sheer licentious rejection of moral restraint. The Puritanism of the Civil War period was now merely a subject for hilarity and ridicule. The Cavalier Parliament, reflecting more the religious side of this anti-Puritan frenzy, legally re-established the Church of England as a fully Episcopal church, worshipping according to a slightly revised Anglican prayer book with the monarch as supreme governor. The Act of Uniformity in May 1662 required all parish clergy to submit unconditionally to the doctrine and worship of the restored Anglican Church, promising never to attempt any change to the status quo in church or state, and to receive episcopal ordination if they lacked it. The Act came into effect on St. Bartholomew's Day, the 24th of August. When it did, almost 1,000 clergy left the established church. The figure is often given as 2,000, but this larger number is obtained by adding on a further 700 or so clergy who had already left under the provisions of the September 1660 Act for confirming and restoring of ministers, which among other things required an acknowledgement of royal supremacy over the church. Plus, some 200 university lecturers, ordained men, also expelled for their Puritanism. And then in the Anglican Church in Wales, another 120 clergy lost their livings. In all, between 1660 and 1662, the established church lost roughly one-fifth of its ministers. Now, the Puritan-minded clergy who left the established church between 1660 and 62 were not the only ones to suffer. The Cavalier Parliament enacted a series of repressive measures affecting all non-Anglicans, both ministers and laity. So, Congregationalists or Independents, Baptists, Quakers, and every other brand of non-conforming Protestant, in addition to the Presbyterians, all were affected. Together, they made up around 10% of the English population. We can summarise the repressive legal measures against them as follows. The Corporation Act of 1661 required all who held any kind of public office, from the lowest to the highest, to take part in Holy Communion in the Anglican Church within 1 year of appointment to office. This made it virtually impossible for devout non-Anglican laymen to be MPs, magistrates, university tutors, etc. The Conventicle Act of 1664 made meetings for unauthorized, non-Anglican worship illegal if there were more than five people present who didn't belong to the same household. When this act was reaffirmed and more rigidly enforced in 1670, the Puritan sympathizing MP and poet, Andrew Marvell, famously denounced it as the quintessence of arbitrary malice. The 5 Mile Act of 1665 prohibited non-Anglican ministers from living or even temporarily lodging within 5 miles of any city or corporate town, or indeed any town where they had functioned as ministers or theological lecturers. There was a get-out clause. The act no longer applied if the minister swore that it was never under any circumstances lawful to take up arms against the king or his government, and that he would never attempt any change to the status quo in church or state, as specified in the Act of Uniformity. Now, together with the Act of Uniformity, these parliamentary enactments have, since the 19th century, collectively been called the Clarendon Code, after the Earl of Clarendon. Probably that's unfair to Clarendon. He was rather less dogmatic and intolerant than the Cavalier Parliament itself. The penalties for violating the code were severe. Crippling fines or imprisonment, including for breaking the code a third time, being shipped out as slave labour to an American or Caribbean plantation for 7 years. The overall result was a gruelling persecution of Protestants by a Protestant state that was almost unparalleled in 17th century Europe. Now, the only place it was worse was Scotland. The next 25 years were to be a long, dark night of the soul for non-Anglican Protestants, non-conformists or dissenters, as they were called. They were now in a worse position than they had ever experienced in English history. All prospect of reforming the Church of England was gone. All prospect of toleration for those outside her precincts was likewise gone. The heady hopes of the Civil War lay in ruins around the heroes of yesterday. One possible response was violent rebellion. Only a few took this course. In January 1661, there was an armed uprising in London to replace King Charles with King Jesus. But only some 50 men took part. Most were killed by government forces and the survivors were executed. Such non-conformist plots and uprisings, of course, hardened the attitude of the government against all non-conformists. The innocent many suffered for the crimes of the reckless few. The Conventicle Act of 1664 was almost certainly a reaction to these insurrectionary plots. How did peaceful non-conformists respond to the Clarendon Code? Well, some, while retaining their personal convictions, renounced the expression of them in worship and attended their parish church. Others sought ingenious ways of complying with the code without abandoning their nonconformity. Adam Martindale, for instance, a Lancashire Presbyterian, preached the same sermon throughout the week to a succession of tiny groups so that the Conventicle Act was not violated. Others disobeyed the code, but took precautions to conceal their disobedience. Some congregations met in the thick of night, sometimes in forests or caves. At Olney, in Buckinghamshire, there was an area called Three Counties Point that bordered on Buckinghamshire, Bedfordshire, and Northamptonshire. A nonconformist group led by John Gibbs worshipped in this area, so that if county officers arrived to arrest them from one county, they could simply slip across the boundary line into a different county. Others fitted out the house where they met with elaborate escape routes in case government agents turned up, concealed trapdoors into cellars, concealed side doors into other rooms, e.g. through a cupboard. The government agents could burst into the room where they believed the illegal worship was taking place, only to find it mysteriously deserted. The independent minister, Thomas Jolly, of Wymondhouses, Lancashire, preached in a room from a desk that was really a folded door to a back staircase. If government agents were spotted, Jolly pulled a cord, which raised the top half of the desk, recreating the door. Consequently, agents entering the room from the front would find a group of people, but no Jolly, who exited by the staircase. Informers were a constant danger. The Clarendon Code awarded them a third of the fine imposed on convicted nonconformists. So there was a strong financial incentive to infiltrate and betray illegal worship meetings. In the Calvinistic Baptist congregation at Broadmead, Bristol, whose pulpit was filled by a variety of preachers, the speaker gave the sermon from behind a curtain so that any visiting informer could hear the preaching and hopefully be converted, but not be able to see or identify the preacher. But despite all these dexterous methods of obeying the Clarendon Code or concealing disobedience, many nonconformists were arrested, convicted, and punished. Over 200 of the clergy expelled from the National Church in 1660 to 62 ended up in prison. Between 1682 and 86, we know that in the City of London alone, over 3,800 nonconformists were arrested and tried for attending illegal worship. It has been estimated that a total number of between 5,000 and 8,000 nonconformists may have died in prison under the Clarendon Code, 17th century prisons being notoriously unhygienic places. How did the three main groupings of nonconformists, the Presbyterians, Independents and Baptists, each respond collectively to the long ordeal? Many Presbyterians continued to hope that the government might have a change of heart, to the extent at least of allowing them back into a broader Anglican church. There were conferences on this between Presbyterian and Anglican divines in 1668, 1674 and 1680, and then one last time in 1689, after the Stuart dynasty had once again been toppled from the throne. But these conferences bore no fruit, and Presbyterians remained outside a national established church which did not want them. In addition, the paralysing restrictions placed on Presbyterian religious activity by the Clarendon Code meant that Presbyterians could not function as a genuinely Presbyterian church. Each congregation was forced, in practice, to act as though it were an autonomous, independent church. English Presbyterianism therefore lost its distinctive identity during the years of repression and became virtually independent in practice. The leading Presbyterian of this period was Richard Baxter, more on him later. Another who came to prominence was John Flavel of Dartmouth in Devonshire. Die-hard Anglicans of the Restoration era sometimes spoke of an unholy trinity of Richard Baxter, John Owen and John Flavel as the three great upholders of nonconformity. Flavel enjoyed unsurpassed success as an evangelistic preacher, and his writings on doctrinal and practical divinity were treasured for their rare marriage of plain speaking and imaginative power. The Fountain of Life Opened, 1672, was perhaps his most significant work. It's an extended meditation in 42 sermons on the person and work of Christ. Another Presbyterian, who now attained his full spiritual stature, as it were, was John Howe. He'd had a brief stint as Cromwell's chaplain, but it was in the Restoration period that Howe's theological maturity produced works of enduring value. These appealed far beyond the nonconformist constituency. Notably, there was The Living Temple in two volumes, 1675-1702, and The Redeemer's Tears Wept Over Lost Souls, 1684. Intriguingly, Howe had been trained at Cambridge University under Henry Moore and Ralph Cudworth, two of the so-called Cambridge Platonists. And some have found Howe's thought a unique bridge between the worlds of Platonism and Puritanism. What about the independents? Well, the independents, or congregationalists, may have profited from the Presbyterians' loss of ethos. Or at least, a significant number of Presbyterian ministers ejected from the church between 1660 and 62 are known to have become independents. Certainly, the independent Presbyterian animosities of the Civil War died away. The two great parties were drawn together in a spirit of unity as fellow sufferers under the Clarendon Code. As Presbyterians lost their church government distinctives, there seemed little to keep the two groups apart. Some independents drew so close to the Presbyterians that they embraced their desire to return into England's national church and joined with Presbyterians in seeking this when the persecution was finally over and a friendly monarch, William of Orange, sat on the throne. They were perhaps harking back to Oliver Cromwell's decentralised live-and-let-live national church of the 1650s, in which independents had indeed been given freedom to minister according to their own ideals. But it was not to be, and the sense that some independents had acquired of being Anglicans in exile was doomed to frustration. Many other independents, however, were glad enough that it should be so. They'd held on resolutely to their belief in strict congregationalism, and they saw no way of melding it with the Anglican system. Anyway, let me give you a little sketch of some of the leading independents. So, first of all, until his death in 1683, John Owen was by far the most influential independent, and we're going to look at him a little bit later, but just footnote him in your mind. After Owen's death, leading figures in independency were Thomas Cole, Isaac Chauncey, and Richard Davis. Now, Thomas Cole was the minister of Silver Street Independent Church in London, and he was notable for defending Reformed orthodoxy against some of Richard Baxter's more debatable ideas on the atonement, imputed righteousness, and the nature of faith and repentance. Isaac Chauncey ministered to the congregation at Mark Lane in London. Now, this was the capital's most distinguished independent church. John Owen had been the previous pastor, and the church was full of members who played a prominent part in the government of Oliver Cromwell, or had married into families connected with the old Cromwellian regime. And then there was Richard Davis, minister of Rotherwell in Northamptonshire. His theology ignited controversy. He was accused of antinomianism. But there could be no denying his passionate commitment to preaching with an evangelistic note. Davis's congregation grew hugely over his 25-year ministry, 795 people coming into membership. And he preached regularly to a circle of some 50 independent churches within an 80-mile radius of Rotherwell. And then the Baptists. Now, Baptists were also drawn closer to Presbyterians and independents in the furnace of the Clarendon Code, that sense of being fellow sufferers. And that probably helps explain why, in 1677, during the period of persecution, the Calvinistic Baptists adopted a slightly modified form of the Westminster Confession, Presbyterian, and Savoy Declaration, independent, as their own doctrinal statement, a self-conscious assertion of pan-reformed brotherhood. That's what we know as the 1689 Baptist Confession. It was republished later, 1689. Surprisingly, the Arminian Baptists of Bedfordshire, Buckinghamshire, Hertfordshire and Oxfordshire did something very similar in 1679 with their Orthodox Creed or a Protestant Confession of Faith, where they emphasised what they had in common with all Reformation Protestants rather than Arminian distinctives. The Orthodox Creed used the framework of Reformed covenant theology and veered so close to Calvinism, teaching perseverance, for instance, that some have seen it as less an Arminian confession, more an Arminian Calvinist synthesis. The motive of these semi-reformed Arminians was stated in the subtitle of their creed, being an essay, attempt, to unite and confirm all true Protestants in the fundamental articles of the Christian religion against the errors and heresies of Rome. Apart from John Bunyan, more on him later, the most important Baptist leader to emerge in this period was Benjamin Keach, pastor of the Calvinistic Baptist Church at Horsley Down in Southwark, South London. A prolific writer, his Tropologia, or A Key to Open Scripture Metaphors, 1682, was long in print as a popular favourite. He's credited with writing the slightly amended Westminster Shorter Catechism for Calvinistic Baptists, Keach's Catechism. But the attribution is doubtful. William Collins seems a more likely candidate. Keach's place in Baptist history is assured, however, by his lively championship of hymn singing in corporate worship. He published a hymn book in 1691, and his was probably the first English congregation of any kind to sing hymns, rather than simply psalms or other Bible passages. Now, there were others who argued in favour of hymn singing, Thomas Manton, Richard Baxter, John Bunyan, but Keach's church actually took the plunge, setting a precedent that would be largely followed by English Protestants in the 18th century. One last development provoked by the Clarendon Code. Because it excluded nonconformists from the Anglican-controlled universities, Oxford and Cambridge, the only two at the time, some alternative method had to be found for educating the sons of non-Anglicans. Nonconformists, therefore, began establishing academies. These academies were colleges of higher education, usually run by one tutor, often a minister with no church. The tutor would gather 20 or 30 young men in his home and put them through 4 years of fairly intensive study. Typical subjects taught in a dissenting academy were Latin, Greek, Hebrew, maths, history, geography, biology, anatomy, rhetoric, ethics, philosophy, law, and theology. Many of the academies were so effective, Anglicans began complaining that nonconformists were receiving a superior education than Oxford or Cambridge could provide. The most famous academy was based in Stoke Newington, London, and was run by the independent minister, Thomas Rowe. Soon, the fate of nonconformists became deeply entangled with a constitutional crisis between Charles II and Parliament, which drove the country to the brink of another civil war. Now, this was owing to Charles's clandestine alliance with the French king, Louis XIV, whose Catholic France was now the dominant power in Europe. The two monarchs pledged their allegiance to each other in the secret Treaty of Dover in June 1670. Louis agreed to pay Charles £160,000 a year. Charles, in turn, would support Louis's foreign policy by joining him in a war against the Protestant Dutch Republic and would convert to Roman Catholicism as soon as politically expedient. In fact, Charles was not to convert until his deathbed, but he almost immediately began using royal authority to improve the condition of English Catholics. They were as legally oppressed as Protestant nonconformists, and had been since Elizabeth I's reign. To disguise his pro-Catholic motives, however, Charles promoted freedom for all non-Anglicans, Catholic and non-conformist alike. He did this by using his alleged power as king to suspend the discriminatory laws passed against non-Anglicans by Parliament. This plunged Charles into prolonged conflict with his MPs over his right to suspend laws properly enacted by Parliament. Charles's suspension of the discriminatory laws came in March 1672 in his Declaration of Indulgence. Nonconformists were now allowed to worship in public on applying for a licence, and many did so, despite doubts about the legality of Charles's methods. Roman Catholics were allowed to worship in private. The indulgence lasted 1 year. But Charles was forced to cancel it in March 1673 because of Parliament's outrage at what they saw as his gross violation of their constitutional authority by his suspending power. MPs also suspected the king's motives, fearing that he was leaning towards Rome, as he was. Despite his secret pension from Louis XIV, Charles was still desperate for cash. He was in debt, and the Dutch war cost 10 times more than the pension. and he needed Parliament's cooperation to raise money legally. So against his wishes, Charles had to agree to Parliament's demand for even stronger anti-Catholic measures. The result was the Test Act of 1673, which required all who held any position of public responsibility to swear an oath denying the doctrine of transubstantiation and to take part in Holy Communion, the Anglican way, within 3 months of appointment to office. Now that was even stricter than the Clarendon Code, which required participation in Anglican Communion within 1 year. This anti-Catholic act was merely the prelude to an outburst of anti-Catholic mania that convulsed the nation, fueled by the public conversion to Catholicism of Charles's brother, James, Duke of York, in 1676. The hysteria reached a pitch of almost insane intensity with the revelation, in inverted commas, of the Popish plot in 1678. This was an alleged Jesuit conspiracy to assassinate Charles, replace him on the throne with Catholic James, and then massacre untold thousands of Protestants. No such plot existed, save in the twisted mind of Titus Oates, who exposed the imaginary plot for reasons best known to himself. For 3 years, England was gripped by a paranoia probably unique in its history. Scores of innocent Catholics were executed, virtually on the say-so of Titus Oates, who was now installed in Whitehall and receiving a handsome salary for his endless perjuries. The paranoia finally burned itself out in 1681. Senior judges reasserted the reign of common sense, and Oates's fall from public favour was spectacular. Deserted by everyone, he was arrested, convicted of perjury, and sentenced to life imprisonment. One of his more enduring legacies was a 1678 act that explicitly prohibited any Roman Catholic from sitting in the House of Commons or the House of Lords. That would not be repealed until 1829, Catholic emancipation. Now, it was in this atmosphere that the exclusion crisis, as it was called, pushed England once again towards civil war. Charles had no legitimate sons, many illegitimate ones, but they didn't count. This meant that should he die, his Catholic brother, James, would inherit the throne. The very idea of a Catholic monarch struck dread into many an English heart. People remembered the persecution of Protestants by the last Catholic monarch, Mary Tudor. A majority of MPs were therefore determined to exclude James from the throne by passing a special parliamentary act to that effect. Now, we shall not follow the political story in detail. Charles dissolved parliaments, summoned new ones, dissolved them again between 1679 and 1681, trying to fend off an exclusion bill. He was adamant that James must be king, partly to give credence to Charles's own secret decision to become Catholic, albeit he was postponing his conversion as long as possible. The parliamentary leader who masterminded the campaign for exclusion was Anthony Ashley Cooper, Earl of Shaftesbury, a self-conscious champion of Protestantism and Parliament against popery and royal tyranny. A wealthy Dorset landowner with strong business interests, Shaftesbury exploited the hysteria of the Popish plot, for all it was worth, in his attempt to keep James from the crown. Shaftesbury had a majority in the various parliaments that sat in 1679 to 81. His pro-exclusion party was nicknamed the Whigs. The name probably derived from the Scottish Whigamore, a cattle thief. Shaftesbury's Whigs were not only opposed to Roman Catholicism and unchecked kingly authority, they also championed the rights of nonconformists to freedom of worship. In the anti-Catholic fever that shook England because of the Popish plot, some nonconformists were able to elude the Clarendon Code and get themselves elected to the House of Commons as Whig MPs. So was forged the intimate alliance of Whigs and nonconformists that would play so long and so influential a part in English politics. Opponents of the exclusion bill that the Whigs were pushing through Parliament were nicknamed the Tories. The word Tory derived from an Irish word for an outlaw. Originally, it described Irish insurgents against the British. But opponents of James, Duke of York, and his claim to the English crown applied it to his supporters, perhaps because Catholic James was seen as a natural ally of the Catholic Irish against the Protestant English. Tories were more devoted to the monarchy than Whigs were, and they would not let Parliament interfere with the line of succession to England's throne. Well, no matter what Charles II did, suspending Parliament, dissolving Parliament, new elections, he could not break the grip that Shaftesbury and the Whigs had on the House of Commons. The exclusion bill looked as though it would keep getting passed by the MPs, but Charles refused to accept it. As King and Parliament confronted each other in an increasingly explosive atmosphere, people muttered that it was 1642 all over again. Charles finally dissolved Parliament for the third time, calling a new one in Oxford rather than London. His purpose was to overawe the MPs with a show of force, and for that he had to get them away from the dangerous London mob that supported exclusion. In Oxford, then, Charles summoned the new MPs, still overwhelmingly Whig, into his presence, where, backed by royal troops, he once more rejected the exclusion bill and dissolved Parliament again. With no London mob to back them, the Whig MPs were powerless. They dispersed. Charles would never again hold a general election for the rest of his reign. Shaftesbury was arrested and charged with treason. He was acquitted by a Whig jury, but fled the country, dying 3 years later as an exile in the Dutch Republic. Charles had made it clear by stationing those royal troops in Oxford that he was ready for violent conflict rather than exclude James from the throne. Were the Whigs ready for such conflict? Well, faced with the question, the great majority preferred to bide their time. A small minority of extremists did plot to assassinate Charles, the Rye House plot of 1683, but the plot was leaked and several leading Whigs were arrested and executed on very flimsy evidence, including Lord William Russell, who died with Christian dignity and was hailed by Whigs as a martyr. An anti-Whig reign of terror was unleashed by Charles in his last 2 years of life, which destroyed the Whigs' legal basis of power by stripping towns and cities of their right to elect magistrates without the king's consent. Although the Triennial Act required a new parliament for 1684, Charles ignored the act. He was now ruling as an absolute monarch. Nonconformists were persecuted more bitterly than ever, tainted in Charles's eyes by their alliance with the Whigs. As he lay dying from a stroke, Charles was received into the Roman Catholic Church in February 1685. On his death, his Catholic brother James succeeded to the throne. All seemed fair for James at first. The Whigs, who had tried to exclude him from the monarchy, had been smashed by Charles II. Meanwhile, James's allies, the Tories, had made passive obedience a first article in their creed. It was never right, under any circumstances, to resist a lawfully crowned king. The only possible problem was that Tories were ardently Anglican, whereas James was Roman Catholic. Thus far, however, he'd played his cards well, never criticising the Church of England, but praising it for its loyalty to him. He was crowned according to a traditional Anglican ceremony, and he publicly promised to respect and maintain the Anglican Church, disavowing any intent to re-Catholicise England. If that relationship between monarch and church ever broke down, James would be in trouble. Within 3 years, it was irreparably broken, and Tories joined with Whigs in ejecting James from the throne. James reassured the country that he was no tyrant by holding a general election. The resulting parliament, which met in May 1685, was Tory-dominated, owing to the way Charles II had stripped towns and cities of their right to elect anyone as MP without royal consent. The Tory MPs were as loyal as James could have wished. They voted him for life, the total income Charles had enjoyed. But there was always going to be some opposition to James. The more fiercely Protestant sections of the population did not believe James's moderate pose, and they would be only too glad to see him fall. Only a month after Parliament met, a violent popular rebellion broke out in the southwestern counties, Devon, Dorset, Somerset. It was led by James Scott, Duke of Monmouth, an illegitimate son of Charles II. Monmouth, a Protestant, had been the Whigs' favoured candidate for the throne in the exclusion crisis and had been implicated in the extreme Whigs' Rye House plot in 1683. He was now living in exile in the Dutch Republic. Well, Monmouth gambled that the strongly Protestant, indeed non-conformist people of the southwestern counties would back his claim to the throne and rise up against James. If he, Monmouth, only showed his face and waved the flag of Protestant revolt against a popish king. Many lower-class non-conformists did indeed rally to Monmouth when he landed at Lyme Regis in Dorset on June the 11th, but none of the Protestant gentry or nobility would support his harebrained scheme. Monmouth's ragtag army was butchered by James' professional forces at the Battle of Sedgemoor in Somerset on July the 6th. Monmouth himself fled, but was captured and executed only a week later. The aftermath of the Monmouth Rebellion was harrowing for nonconformists. James put Judge George Jeffreys in charge of the trials of those taken prisoner during and after the uprising. Jeffreys' conduct was fierce in the extreme. Some 320 people were executed by hanging, and a further 800 or 900 shipped out as slave labour to the Caribbean plantations. The bodies of the executed were put on display at various spots as a gruesome object lesson in the fate of rebels. Two trials in particular achieved infamy. An elderly lady, Alice Lyle, a member of the royalist gentry, was tried for simply giving compassionate shelter to a non-conformist minister and his companion who had fled from Sedgemoor. She was sentenced to death by burning, although in the event James mercifully allowed her to be beheaded. Another lady, the devout Baptist, Elizabeth Gaunt, was tried for attempting to help another refugee flee the country. She was not fortunate enough to belong to the gentry and was actually burnt alive, the last woman to be punished by this method in England. Although most people did not support the Monmouth Rebellion, they were shocked and horrified by the government's brutality in its aftermath. The trials became known as the Bloody Assizes, and Jeffreys acquired the nickname the Hanging Judge. Now, if James's response to the Monmouth Rebellion was not a public relations success, even worse came in October. That month, Louis XIV, Catholic King of France, revoked the Edict of Nantes, which for 100 years had guaranteed the religious liberty of his Protestant subjects, the Huguenots. Huguenot refugees began flooding into England, telling spine-chilling stories of Catholic intolerance in France. James could not prevent his people giving a generous welcome to the Huguenot refugees, but it damaged him very badly. The Protestant English began fearing that Catholic James would sooner or later treat them as Louis XIV had treated French Protestants. When Parliament reassembled in November, James unnerved the MPs by demanding huge sums to increase the size of the royal army. He'd become paranoid about further rebellions. He also informed Parliament that the Catholic military officers he'd appointed, contrary to the Test Act of 1673, would stay in command because he could not trust anyone else to be faithful to him. Pro-James, though the Tory MPs were, they were alarmed. Was this James creating a Catholic army to impose his religion on England? They would not vote him the large sum he required, so he suspended Parliament. In reality, he had dissolved it, for this particular Parliament would never meet again. In 1686, James began taking measures to promote Catholicism. He did this by using the monarch's alleged dispensing power to exempt individuals from the discriminatory religious laws against them. He now employed this power to exempt Catholics from the Test Act and put them in top positions in the army, the universities, and the royal government. James deliberately arranged for an important legal case to come to trial that year. It involved a Catholic army officer, Edward Hales, who argued that the king's dispensing power gave him the right to his military commission without taking the anti-Catholic oaths required by the Test Act. Prior to the trial, James dismissed from office almost all the judges who, on being asked, said they did not believe in the legality of the dispensing power. As a result, not surprisingly, the verdict given on June the 21st was a great victory for James. 11 of the 12 judges declared in favour of Hales, accepting the validity of his argument about the dispensing power of the monarch. So England's judiciary had checkmated England's parliament and given James the green light to pursue his policy of staffing the nation's leading institutions with Catholics. Shall we have our break at that point, and then we'll resume and look at how James tried to re-Catholicise the nation and the response of Protestants to that. So, what, a 7 or 8 minute break?